Okay. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be here, Dr. Perry and the organisers. And today I'm going to be speaking about really a follow-up presentation to a presentation I gave at Joplin last year on the California Commercial Ranch Project. And given some of you weren't at Joplin, I'll go through a little bit what that is. And basically, we were using DNA technology, but not in the way that the previous speaker was talking about for genetic predictions, but rather in a fairly simplistic way to just determine which sire was the bull that was associated with calves in a multi-sire breeding pasture situation. And I think we have some pretty interesting data that's come out of this three-year project in California, and I'm going to go through some of the economic ramifications that we are having a look at with regards to the data that we've collected, and at the end of the day have a look at the practical implications and take-home messages. And I feel a little bit of an orphan at this conference because I'm going to be speaking about not using any reproductive technologies, but rather working with commercial ranchers that are not using AI and are really just using natural service bulls. And so it's a little bit of a technology step down in terms of where we've been for the rest of this conference. But there's actually a lot of tie-in points that I think bring home some of the points that previous speakers have made. So the California Commercial Ranch Project is basically a USDA-funded project where for 3 years we followed all the calves that were produced on three large commercial ranches in Northern California and basically took DNA samples from mostly commercial Angus bulls, about 150 all told during the course of the whole trial, that were mated with about 210 cows per year. And we followed their progeny. We DNA tested their progeny using hair follicles at weaning, matched up those calves to their particular sires, and then followed those calves down through the feedlot, and particularly we went to the Harris feedlot and worked closely with them to then follow those animals through into the processing plant, where we took meat samples from them at grading so that we could match up the carcass characteristics and phenotypes with DNA to make sure that we didn't have any rail outs or phenotypic mix-ups in the processing plant, and put all of that data together to then allow us to have basically a large validation population developed on commercial animals to then test the accuracy or how well the different genetic prediction equations, be they from universities or private companies, were actually able to predict the genetic merit of these commercial Angus bulls. And so basically, at the end of the day, we basically took DNA on all those bulls, and this was a real collaborative project. We took the DNA and worked with Jerry Taylor at Missouri and John Pollock, who was at Cornell but is now at the Meat Animal Research Center, to do 50K genotyping, and since then 800,000K genotyping. We then got molecular breeding value predictions for various traits with collaborators at Iowa, Missouri, and the Meat Animal Research Center. And then most importantly, and the focus of my discussion today, is working with the producers, the commercial producers in Northern California, and Dr. Dan Drake, my co-author, collecting all of that ranch phenotype data so that we would have information for this validation population. Then we worked with the feedlot to get steer in weights and performance data of all of those steers and heifers that all got shipped down to the Harris Ranch in California. And then also we got the carcass data. And then finally, of course, at the end of the day, there's some poor grad student that's responsible for compiling all that data and seeing how well the DNA tests were actually working. And that's Christina Weber, who's a PhD student in my lab. So to give you some feel for a scope of what we're talking about here, we're basically, in today's discussion, talking about all of the 2009 and 2010 born calves that came out of these commercial ranches, and we followed them all the way through to the feedlot. And that picture on the left of your screen there kind of gives you some sort of a feel for where the commercial ranches are, and you'll see them way up in Northern California, right on the Oregon border there is where they're located. In the middle there is UC Davis, which is kind of central Northern California, and then Harris Ranch is much further south down down towards Southern California, with the feedlot being located there on I-5 for any of you that have ever driven through there, and the processing plant is a little bit further east than that. And for those of you that maybe haven't got much of a California perspective, maybe this helps understand what I was talking about. So from a California perspective, there's kind of up north where the ranches are, there's Hollywood down south there, and then everyone else is kind of back east, or else you're in the Pacific Ocean. And so I guess I'm back east right now, even though South Dakota might not think they are. But to give you some sort of a Midwest perspective, this is a size graph of Nebraska kind of covering that area. And so it's quite a large distance between where these cattle are raised and where they eventually get slaughtered. So the commercial ranches we were working with was the Cowley Ranch, which has about 20 bulls going out with cows in both a spring and a fall calving season. And that picture there is Jack Cowley in the dark jacket, and Dan Drake, the advisor that worked on this project with us. The Cook Ranch is run by three brothers, and they have also a fall and a spring breeding season, and they have about 10 bulls per season going out with their cows in multi-sire breeding pastures. And then finally, Moll Richardson Farms has just a fall calving season, and they have quite a large herd with about 30 bulls going out in a fairly large multi-sire breeding situation. And of the three ranches, they had a little bit of a longer breeding season. The other two tended to have a pretty tight 45 to 60-day breeding season. Moll Richardson is a much more extensive property, and they tended to have a little bit of a longer breeding season. Then finally, as I mentioned, we followed, and when those cattle were getting through grading, we would go and take a piece of meat sample from the neck of these carcasses to match up the carcass data with the DNA from the ranch cattle to make sure we were still looking at the same animal to ensure data integrity. I will just mention, you know, when we started this project, there's a lot of record keeping involved in making sure you keep everything straight when you're taking DNA, and you've got, as it happens every year, you have a new group of cattle with exactly the same ranch number. And so we tried to implement EIDs, electronic identifications, to uniquely identify the animals. And being tech geeks, we tried to get all of these different technologies to work on the ranch. And I won't sugarcoat the problems that we had getting various bits of equipment to speak to each other, and quite often there was three or four of us out there just dealing with com ports and all the rest of it, and it was really quite frustrating. And I really can't emphasize enough how important the cooperating ranchers were to getting our data for us, and also helping us work with these new technologies and understand how a producer would go about trying to implement some of this technology in commercial production systems. We often had bulls that were not all that excited about working with us, like that guy in the top left there. We'd get tails come in that were less than pristine in terms of their hygiene, trying to get DNA samples from it. But our producers did it with good humour, and I can't underestimate the value of their substantial contribution of time, labour and expense to get the data I'm going to talk about. With regards to the technology, you know, the first year it was pretty ugly when you're working cattle, especially at weaning. Everyone's in a hurry, and when the computer goes down and the EID reader stops talking to the wand, people get very annoyed. And so we had constant problems, but as we got more experience, they declined with time, which was good. And it seemed like each additional piece of equipment kind of exponentially increased the problems as it tried to interact with other pieces of equipment. And we really did have to have a very high understanding of computer in order to be able to troubleshoot and get the information that we needed out of it. Having said that, we had computers out in the dust and the rain and the mud, and a portable scale we took around, and during the whole period we never had any of that totally fail on us. But the record keeping was really important to keep this data integrity intact. So with that background then, I'm going to summarise basically the data I presented here at Joplin last year. And what I'm showing you here is the average number of calves that were produced per commercial ranch bull in a given breeding season. And so what you see in this particular table is the three ranches, broken down by year, broken down by season, the number of sires that were out on that particular season and ranch, the mean bull age, which has got an average down the bottom of about 3.3 years, the total number of calves, and then the range of calves per bull. And you can see there we had anything from 1 to 48 calves being produced per bull, and this was with the proviso that they had to produce at least one calf. But I'll draw your attention to the wording at the bottom there, where in any given bull breeding season, about 7% of the sires had zero calves. These had all been through breeding soundness examinations. They appeared to be fertile, healthy bulls. But a remarkably consistent number we got was that on average the commercial ranch bulls were producing around about 19 calves in any given breeding season. When you average out the really good ones and the really bad ones, it's about 19 calves per breeding season. So the purpose of the paper that's in the proceedings this time was to, okay, we've got all of these records now. What we're interested in is comparing the projected income that would have been derived from bulls if we had sold the calves as feeders, or I heard the term a cash load this morning, or if we'd retained ownership, and that is we'd gone to the grid with them, and have a look whether there's any difference in the bulls with regards to those two different marketing systems. And this was done in collaboration with Dr. Scott Brown from Missouri, who's an economist. And so as an economist, there's a million assumptions that had to be made. They're all in the proceedings paper, and I'm not going to go into great detail there. But suffice to say that basically he used a set point in time when feeder prices were a certain amount, feed was a certain amount, and that's all going to vary over time. And so this is really just a snapshot of what we would have done if we'd worked with the prices that are assumed in the paper. And the bottom line is that if we look at the averages of the type of animals we were working with, their feedlot in weights averaged about 706 pounds, and the average feeding period for these cattle was 152 days. Their carcass traits were 743 pounds of carcass weight. They were about 85% choice, only 1.3% prime, which is not uncommon in our feeding systems, yield grade 3.2, fat thickness 0.62, and ribeye area 12.8 was the averages for all of these cattle going into this system. So this particular figure is shown in your proceedings, and basically what it shows is if you look at the blue bars, they go with the left-hand axis, and it shows the difference in sires, that's across the x-axis on the bottom, between the average value of a calf from that sire sold as a feeder calf or a cash load. And the red squares show the average gross value of the average calf from those sires going over to the right axis sold on the grid. And so the bottom line is that there are significant differences between sires in terms of the average value of a calf that sire produces depending upon what production system they go into. And however, the gross value in the of the grid value animal obviously has to have feeding costs removed in order for you to get the actual value that was derived from that animal, and that's what this graph here shows. And basically what this is the value of the retained value minus the feeding costs and the feedlot costs that would have been associated with raising those calves. And so any time the blue bar is higher than the red dot, on average, that particular sire's offspring got a higher value when they were sold as a cash load, whereas any time the red square is above the blue bar, the average of the calves that came from that particular bull would have been better off being used in a retain ownership system or as sold on the grid. So if you actually subtract the value of the cash load from the grid value, that's what's kind of shown in this particular graph. And the way to interpret this is anything to the left of that blue arrow is calves that on average brought back more money, up to $50, $60 per calf on the grid. And anything to the the left of that arrow, are calves that would have been better off being sold as a cash load than retained ownership in this particular economic scenario. So there were differences between bulls in terms of whether their calves did better on the grid or better as a cash load. But I think the really important take-home message from this trial is the next slide, and I'm going to walk you through it, because really now we put into the calculations the impact of progeny or prolificacy, how many calves that particular calf bull had. So the little green line that's trickling across the bottom there is the number of progeny per sire, and if you go off, that kind of goes with the right axis. So on average, there was about somewhere between 50 and 0 being produced, and it's in order of how many actual progeny that particular sire has. So the sire on the far left had about 50 progeny per year. So then the blue value in this case is the total number of progeny times the feeder value per progeny for that particular sire. And you can see when you do that calculation that sire on the far left is bringing back about $45,000 in income to the ranch as a result of the fact that he's producing a really large number of offspring. And the difference between the blue bars and the red squares is the differential between whether you would have sold them as a cash load or whether you would have sold them on the grid. And you can see in almost all cases that the blue bars and the red squares almost overlap. In other words, the number of progeny per sire is by far the dominant factor determining the income return from that sire to the ranch. And in fact, the progeny per sire explained about 98.4% of the variation in the sire's total income, irrespective of marketing scheme. And so this is a really important factor that's driving how much those particular commercial sires are bringing back to the ranch. And so what we'd really like to know, the little kind of purpley line that's going across there shows you the difference in the average feeder value of the sires. And so although you might think that this particular sire here is a really good animal because its average feeder price is really important, if he's only producing 2 calves, then he's really not generating very much for your bottom line. And so that's kind of what this data is suggesting, is that this is a really important factor. So is there any way we can predict which bulls are going to actually be more prolific bulls in a multi-sire commercial breeding situation? And so in order to look at that, we basically plotted all of the different EPDs that we had associated with these Angus bulls to see if there was any traits that were associated with bull prolificacy or number of offspring that a bull produced. And you can see here on this particular graph, I've got scrotal circumference EPD across the x-axis and then the number of progeny on the y-axis. And I've got one particular bull circled there, and that's the kind of the blue circle up there. And that was bull number 901, who was a real outlier in every statistical test we ever did because he was producing way more progeny than might have been predicted given the scrotal circumference EPD. And so being a good scientist, I just discarded his data because it wasn't really fitting with our hypothesis, but basically he did seem to be a very big statistical outlier. And if you actually did that and then ran the numbers, you can see that there is a positive correlation between scrotal circumference EPD, either using data from all 3 ranches without that one particular 901 bull in there, or if you just look at the trend from ranches A and B, which didn't have that outlier bull in there. And if you actually do the math on that, you can kind of get some sort of a feel for what's the relationship between scrotal circumference EPD and number of calves. And that's what these next 3 graphs show, and these also are in your proceedings. And basically, you can, if you put all of the different EPDs into a model and have a look at this data, you can get an estimate of the slope here. And basically what this says is, as you go from 0 to 1 centimetre scrotal circumference EPD, which is a really big range, just to be aware, we're not talking measurements here, we're talking EPDs, there's an average increase of about 8.2 progeny if you were to compare a 0 EPD bull to a 1 EPD bull for scrotal circumference. And because there's such a strong association between overall number of progeny and income that's derived from feeder calves, then you can see that there's going to be a similar association between scrotal circumference EPD and ranch income from the bull, be it from feeder calves or be it from retained ownership calves. And so although this particular number was definitely positively correlated in a very significant way with the total number of progeny per sire, it only explained about 5% of the genetic variation. So I don't want to overstate the importance of scrotal circumference EPD in terms of it. There's a lot of other factors that go into how many calves a sire actually has, but it is at least something that could be used in selection for commercial ranch bulls that are going to be in multi-sire breeding situations to potentially try to get those bulls that are going to derive a large number of progeny. So that's prolificacy. There were also some association between EPDs and how well cattle graded. And if you look particularly in the situation of cattle that graded choice plus or better, i.e. prime, so they would be kind of CAB type cattle, there was a linear relationship between dollar G marbling, dollar quality grade and dollar B, and the ultimate grading values of those particular bulls. And so that's shown in figure 8 in your binder. And basically what this shows is that there's a range of percentage choice or better, ranging from 80% in the case of the bull on the far left all the way down to 0 in the case of the bulls on the far right there. And you can see that there is a linear association there with an upward trend between either dollar G on the left axis or marbling EPD on the right axis and ultimate percent grading choice plus or better. And so that's for the average of an animal. And so that's an important thing if you're comparing two EPDs, two straws of semen you're going to put into a bull. Of course, EPDs are going to be really important to determine the quality of those calves coming out. And if you're comparing two straws of semen, that's a really important measurement. When you're comparing two commercial bulls, the important thing is that those bulls have to get the cows pregnant. And so that's an additional consideration that's not considered when you're putting two straws of semen into a synchronized animal versus a commercial ranch bull. The other thing we looked at was the effect of calving distribution, and this kind of ties in really nicely to some of the talks that were happened this morning. And we basically broke up the calves that were sired by the different bulls in either the first 21 days or the subsequent 21 days or past 64 days in this analysis. And what was kind of unique was because we were able to tie back all of the calves to their particular bull, we were actually able to pull out the genetic effects associated with a particular bull siring a calf from the days in the calving season when that particular calf was born. And so it gives us the ability to really have a look at the effect of calving distribution independent of the genetics of the bull. And that was a kind of a unique thing that we were able to do with this particular data set. So the first thing we looked at was how many conceptions per week did the prolific bulls get, the most prolific bulls, in the first 10 weeks of the breeding season versus the least prolific bulls in the breeding pasture. And you can see that there's a significant difference in all the way through to 10 weeks between the number of conceptions that the prolific bulls got per week versus the number that the poorly prolific bulls got, and that the average in the first 3 weeks of that important 21 days was about 6 conceptions per prolific bull per week. That was on average there, and very significant differences between the two bulls. And then similar to some of the data that's been presented by other researchers this morning, there was a significant difference between the value that was returned from animals depending upon whether they were born in the first 21 days, the second 21 days, the third 21 days, or the fourth 21 days. And basically, this is the feeder calf value that was returned per head, and you're looking at about a $50 spread in terms of return depending upon when the calves were born in the breeding season. And this was with the sire effects included, so you might have had some EPD differentials between these data. This is with the sire effects removed, and you can see quite clearly that that's just a calving distribution effect, and again, it's about $50. We saw similar trends to what Rick Funston's seen in terms of quality grade and carcass weight and the like, and consequently, we also saw a significant difference between the retained ownership value of calves born in the first 42 days of the breeding season versus those that were born later later in the breeding season. And so what we'd really like to see is bulls that are getting a large number of cows pregnant in those first 21 days of the breeding season. And so they're obviously the types of bulls that would be the most desirable from an economic perspective and return the most value to the ranch. And basically what these last two graphs show you is the cumulative percentage of total feeder calf value that happens in the first 21 days of the calving season and the second 21 days of the calving season. And if you look at about 42 days, depending upon the ranch and the season, anywhere between 70 and all the way up to 90% of ranch income has already been carved out by the 42 days into the calving season, and the dribs and drabs go on here. Obviously, we had a little bit of an extended breeding season for there still to be guys coming at that particular rate, but that happens. And similarly, we saw a very analogous trend occurring when we were looking at the cumulative percent of total retained ownership value, and with about 80% of the value from those first two periods. So just the summary and practical implications of what we found then was that the number of calves born per sire per calf crop varied from 0 to 54 in this study. And the number of progeny per sire explained most of the variation, 98.4% of the sire's total income derived per breeding season, whereas the individual calf value explained only another 0.88% of the variation. And this clearly supports, in the case of when we're talking about commercial sires that are out there in a multi-sire breeding situation, the old adage that any calf is better than no calf. But I do want to take that with the proviso that, okay, now if we're dealing with a situation where we've got a timed AI breeding of cattle, then obviously other EPDs are going to play into this, and there might be a much higher effect of, for example, quality of those calves if you've got retained ownership, when you're not taking into account the fact that there's different numbers of calves that are being produced by the bulls. And so I do want to have that take-home message there. But if you are in a multi-sire breeding commercial situation, it might be worth taking into account scrotal circumference and cow energy value, which was also associated with herd sire prolificacy, that is the number of calves and consequently both total feeder and retained ownership value per sire. There were four EPDs that were linearly related to the percent grading choice plus or prime, and so if you're really chasing those high quality cattle, then these particular EPDs in our data set were positively associated with the percent grading choice or prime. The calves from the first 21 days of the calving season returned about 40% of ranch income, and those from the first two breedings basically accounted for about 72% of the return to the ranch, again emphasising the importance of those early bred calves. And I guess overall the data suggests that the inclusion of scrotal circumference and dollar energy EPDs might be a useful selection criteria in commercial herd sire selection, and I think really emphasises the importance of management approaches, be they timed AI, be they whatever they are, to increase the proportion of calves born in that first 21 or at most 42 days of the calving season. So with that, I will finish and take any questions.